Hello, and welcome to the Text in Us podcast. I'm your host, George Fricks, and I'm here with my co-host, L. Grover Fricks, to resume discussions by having a mailbox episode.
Woohoo! That's right. We are there. We're there early. We said we were going to do it at the end of Exodus, so apologies to everyone whose groove has been thrown off.
Groove has been thrown off.
But I'll be on a Bema work thing next week. So here we are recording this little bit ahead of time. So thank you all for sending in so many kind words and encouragements and updates on different situations. If yes. I've been emailing you in the past, people sent in things like the wedding went great. I'm so happy to hear that. That's wonderful. When we read these questions, some of them have been edited down for brevity. Sometimes they're edited down because there's some personal information that maybe you don't want the whole world to hear. And so just bear that in mind that this is not, I haven't changed anyone's questions, but there are chunks missing, just acknowledging that. But why don't we start out with Bernadette's questions?
Yeah. Our first question comes from Bernadette, who asks us about what translations we recommend. She also shared a couple of recommendations that are given by Dan McClellan on Instagram, who recommends Robert Alter's translation of the Hebrew Bible, the JPS Tanakh, NRSV, the Gospels by Sarah Rudin, and the NET translations. So what are your thoughts, Elle?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked about this Bible translations before, but it's an easy, quick answer. Very easy to talk about. Shifting all the time. People all have different preferences.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Certainly, we have perhaps an undue or unprofessional amount of shade at times to different translations. But honestly, the one that, you know, you are used to,
right,
and
gets
that
you
grew
in the text,
up with, whatever is getting you in the text, right, that's what we want, is people falling in love with the Word of God. So that's what's most important. Following that up, though, I do still have preferences.
Let's get personal.
So like you said, Robert Alter is great. I still have plenty of disagreements with him, but he has these footnotes, which are fantastic.
Yeah.
So it helps you to see more of his thinking. No one's going to line up exactly, of course, with what I think, and that's perfectly fine. KJV, I've been surprised at how consistent it is over and over. I'll go over and check the KJV, and maybe it's clunky and maybe it's difficult, and yet it is often
doing
has a high level of fidelity to the Hebrew, right?
Yeah.
JPS Tanakh can be great. Agreeing with Dan McClellan there to pop over and see what's going on. I'm not familiar with Sarah Rudin's Gospels, so I can't issue a statement on that. NRSV can be a good fallback. You know, Jewish Orthodox Bible is a little bit confusing because it's not actually Jewish Orthodox. The Orthodox Jewish Bible is a Messianic translation. So as long as you know that, and maybe you're trying to like learn some anglicized Hebrew, then that can be fun to throw into the mix. But it was kind of a specific use. I don't follow Dan McClellan in my social media or my educational intake, but I know people who do, and I've seen some of his public work, his educational things that he puts out there into the world. I certainly appreciate a lot of the things that he's trying to do and ways that he is pushing back at some sentiments about the Bible or about Christianity that are can be virulent. He is LDS, so that's important to know. He has his PhD in theology and religion from the University of Exeter. So it is good to know when someone has their PhD. That's a great mark of somebody who's done their research work, and it's from a secular university, which I also respect. I think that secular universities can do a great job being more open-handed with things that their students are free to pursue. So there is that. That does not mean that I endorse all of the things he says, right? He's often coming at biblical stories with a minimalist approach to veracity of what actually happened in the text, right? And that's totally fine. It's just not always my cup of tea. So yeah, feel free to learn from whomever you enjoy learning from. Of course, I think it's great to learn from people who you don't always agree with. Sometimes we can get into that space of being like, it's, you know, there's safe people to learn from and there's unsafe people to learn from.
Right.
It's more that there's a lot of people to learn from. And sometimes you need to exercise your critical thinking more. I mean, we should always be doing that, but sometimes it might be more challenging than other times. So just because we disagree with someone on something doesn't mean that we can't learn from them.
Right.
We should seek that out and pursue it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I do follow his Instagram, and it is great stuff, you know, and he's definitely, I think, just like you said, you know, just be aware of whoever you're listening to, what their basis is, right? What's the lens that they're doing things through, you know, be informed, being an informed listener, and it's all good stuff. So,
yeah,
excellent. Well, thank you, Bernadette. I want to go on to this next group of questions. We got a couple from Diane. Thank you, Diane. You always send in such lovely questions to us, and we love to get to see them.
Yeah.
We're going to look at two of your questions here. The first one is from chapter 24 of Exodus, and you asked, why does it say no one will see God and live if they see him here?
Great question, Diane. That is an excellent theological problem.
It's a question for the ages. It's the troubling point for rabbinical commentary and arguments.
It's a troubling point for Trinitarians,
yeah,
right? Because Jesus is God, and surely thousands of people saw God, therefore, when he was on the earth, and they did indeed live. And so I love the question. I think it's worth digging into, and I know we didn't really do that on that episode. What could the tools that we immediately pull from then, if something doesn't totally line up with the rest of scripture in a really easy alignment, right? If Hagar sees God, maybe not God's face, right? Moshe sees God. The Sanhedrin, the forerunners to the Sanhedrin, see God at that banquet. All these different people see God and they do live. Then what's going on? If I was going to chase down this question, I would start looking at cultural clues. I would start hunting around and seeing what was the theology of different religions in the ancient Near East.
Yeah.
Did they believe that they could see God and live, right? Could this be a quote of a contemporary culture in which Moshe and God are putting a little twist on it, right? If that doesn't turn out to be the case, my solve, which I don't think is that good, would be, well, no one can see the fullness of God and live, right? It doesn't seem like Hagar sees like the entirety of God. Moshe doesn't. But our prophets, this is why it's not a very good thing. Our prophets go up to heaven and see God sitting on
right.
a chair and the pillars shaking and his rainbow overhead and a robe filling the temple. Like that feels like seeing all of God. So I don't know, Diane, but great question.
It's a wonderful question.
I love that you're listening critically.
Yeah, and maybe you can kind of, I don't know, ponder about like the aspect of God is not just in one thing, right? It might not just be in a visual representation or an auditory representation or whatever. And maybe what's being talked about here is the fullness of God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are different ways to, you know, parse that out. So it's lovely. And I also think we trap ourselves by thinking that people of the ancient world only saw gods as the physical idol itself, when in reality, oftentimes the idol is still a representation of the god that they worship.
Right, right. Yeah. When we say worshiping idols, that word worship is either bow in the Hebrew or it's serve.
Yeah.
So it's not about like, bowing to the idol and being like, this is my God.
Right.
I think that's being a little bit facetious or satirical when the prophets do that. I think they're making a larger point when they say that, because they did believe that their gods were floating around in the air,
yeah,
and in the sky and in the stars and
yep,
all of those things. So, yep, great question. The other one we're going to talk about today is from Exodus 32. And Diane had this clarifying question. When we talk about Azara that Rashi quoted, who is that character, he thinks? So, point of confusion there. We did talk about the concept of how it gets pronounced in the Jewish community is Avodah Zarah, which is really confusing because it makes
just
it sound like
it,
one large,
yeah,
long word.
Quickly.
But the two words that they're actually saying there are Avodah and then Zarah. Avodah means work or service, and we translate it worship because
mm-hmm,
that's what we do.
Yeah.
And then Zarah means strange or other. And so this is talking about these stories in the text where people offered strange fire before,
right,
God and got murdered for it, right? Because God is a very specific way that he's given us to worship. And so in the Jewish community, though, that can look a bajillion ways. If you walk into Notre Dame, you're committing the sin of Avodah Zarah. So it's not a character. It's a concept. And it's a kind of sin.
Right. Designating,
right,
something.
Strange worship in the Jewish community.
Yeah.
Great. Clarifying question.
Wonderful. Okay. Janessa has some questions for us. The first one is, she says, I currently homeschool my kids and I'm looking for some ideas/resources on ways I can teach them to have a deep faith and teach them about God. And for the younger ones, it seems easier, but my older son would like to have something. It seems like a lot of the family devotions out there are still rooted in some of the traditions that I'm trying to get away from. That is a great question. That is a very difficult thing. How do we find updated resources, especially when it comes to instructing our children,
kiddos,
in faith?
Yeah, absolutely. I love this question. We're certainly on that journey too with our kids, though they are 3 and 1 rather than 9, 5, and 3. My suggestion, of course, only slightly self-serving. The
conflict of interest warning.
Not really, because I won't make any money off of it at all from sales. But the Book of Belonging,
yes,
the children's Bible, which is coming out, I believe, this late fall or winter. I'm super excited for it. It's gorgeously illustrated. It has exercises that you can do with your kiddos. It's got great, it's more of a retelling of different stories than a paraphrase style. So as long as you enjoy that and you're open to that, it's really accessible for that range of ages. I worked on the manuscript with the authors, and it should be really good. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah.
So that'll be coming out. What we do right now is I read the straight Bible, straight being a translation from whatever is on our shelf at that particular moment, to my kiddo, even though he's 3 in the morning. The 3-year-old, I do change the words just spontaneously while I'm talking, like disciples become students because my son knows what a class and students are. Talmidim, I feel okay about that. So I make those changes as I talk to try to keep him more engaged and ask him questions throughout. But a 9-year-old certainly is able to engage with some of that. Perhaps horrifyingly for those of us who are struggling to keep up, alephbeta.org, of course, Rav Foreman's website and,
yeah,
ministry was originally intended for children, and has, you know, the cute cartoons illustrating all of the things that might be shooting above your 9-year-old's head, but can still be engaging stuff to,
right,
use that you could certainly learn alongside them at the same time. So that's always fun.
Yeah.
I'm so excited to start adding, as we're out in this space longer, more resources. Hopefully, as time goes on, I know it's a frequent question over at Bama too. So that's what I do. I edit the vocabulary of the word while I'm reading it to my kids.
Yep.
But I'm excited for further options in the future.
Yeah. And I would say, just to put tag on to the end there, is that our kids are the best imitators of ourselves.
Right.
And to find ways throughout the day while you are in relationship and working with your children to point out the ways that we do things that are, you know, Christ driven, right? Gospel oriented things. And, you know, there can be a range based on how old your kids are. That can be just from, you know, we don't just not want to hit people, but the reason why we don't hit our sibling when XYZ happens is
right.
because we are operating out of love and forgiveness and,
right.
you know, model for them what it looks like to be like Christ, you know, and that makes a big
difference.
You know,
the easy thing,
the easy
says
one.
George, just look like Jesus all the time.
All the time.
It'll be fine. Yeah, anytime that you're having those frequent parenting discussions like, hey, why do we share? We share because God gives us good things to enjoy, but also to be generous and increase our joy by sharing with others.
And it can be a good motivator for, you know, your own orthopraxy.
Right, right. Very good. Very good. She had one other question. Thank you, Janessa. I'm listening to this episode about Moshe's father-in-law and the name change. What if it's two different people? What if the priest has this man's daughters working for him? And since he's the priest, he has authority to assign a daughter from someone else to marry Moshe since he was so helpful.
Yeah.
I love the creativity of this. I love playing around with thinking about why are the three names and not just
right.
shrugging and walking away from it. But
it's
trying.
Great.
It is great. The thing that is challenging about that particular solution is for two of the names, it is the same title is given to both, which is the word father-in-law. So it's not that there is this high priest named Yitro, and then there was you know, some other guy who shows up around Tzipora, right? And so it could have been a priest. That's the same name three different ways. It's really mostly two ways, and one way has an extra vowel on it.
Okay.
Yeter and Yitro are close enough, but the other one is like friend of God, right?
Right. Ruel,
neighbor to God. And they both get the title father-in-law. So the possibilities there, if you want to go with two different people, is that Tzipora has two dads, which seems unlikely, right?
I mean, maybe it's just one of those cultures where you have multiple husbands, you know?
Yes, anthropologically, that is possible.
Yeah.
Very fun things to try to figure out, though.
I like it. It's great. John asks about Exodus 28. He was listening about the description of the clothing. And as we were talking about the stones, he mentions that he was thinking of something small in size for the shoulders and the gold things that hold them in place. And he remembers telling his class to think about these two stones. And something to think about is how large were the stones. And he says, if God wanted Aaron to remember in verse 12, God's people, wouldn't it help if those stones were more like rocks on Aaron's shoulders? And as he moved about, the rocks might have been uncomfortable. And maybe Aaron couldn't help but remember the weight of God's people. And sometimes a little discomfort can help us remember things better.
I love that, John. I think no and yes at the same time. I also love that you're teaching your Sunday school class Exodus 28. That's awesome.
It's fantastic.
You know, not just staying in the same texts all the time, the same stories. So power to you there. But so for something small in size for the stones where you have to write six names on each one, the gems that we have found that do have inscriptions on them are very small. People have these tiny, tiny chisels, and you have to practically use a microscope. That's an exaggeration. Mm. But if you look up like inscribed stone and just Google it for Iron Age or whatever, you will see like these little chips that you can barely recognize as like Hebrew letters, but when you put them all together, you can be like, oh, that's God's name. Cool. So they did have the expertise and skill to be able to make something that small. I do really like what you're saying, though, about if they're bigger, then it's something that's very present with you, right? That's yeah. the concept of tefillin and the tzitzit and wrapping up your arm with this black leather band that goes up and ties something to your forehead, right? That's a very embodied practice that is a very physical sensory reminder of having God's word. Right. On your heart, in your hand, between your eyes at all times. So I do like that idea, and it's totally possible that that's the case.
Well,
it just doesn't have to be.
Yeah, but with that, like, they would not have to be that big for them to start to be uncomfortable, right? He's wearing these all the time.
Right.
You know, 10 pounds. You just think about 10 pounds.
Right, but 10 pounds is still... big rock. That's still a big rock.
Well,
that's
we got
still,
the gold on here, right? Gold is heavy.
Yeah, but that's just to tie them down. That's just the setting.
It's, well, even three pounds. Hold up a book and hold it all day. You are going to get tired.
It's still a big rock, but I hear you. It doesn't have to be that big to be uncomfortable is what I hear you saying.
Yep.
Totally. His other two questions, I will read. He also sent in, I know you have stated the Strong's Concordance isn't the best, but it is the dominant one out there. What other source would you suggest? Thanks for your help. Absolutely. It is the dominant source out there. It's still the easiest thing to use, despite our complaining about it. It is does have function, right, in that you can say HA151 or whatever and
right.
look that up. Bing, there it is. So it's helpful for communicating, and it's helpful for indexing. It's helpful for most of the things it was designed to do. The other main... big name resources out there are the Brown Driver Briggs, the BDB, followed up by my personal favorite, Jesenius. And those are kind of thicker than a concordance is, but they're also the other things that are on BLB. So the way that we suggest that people use Blue Letter Bible is when you are looking at a particular word, I'm looking at the word pakad, because it's what was suggested in my history when I started to type in Blue Letter Bible. You'll see Strong's definitions, and I would just skim past the spot that says Strong's definitions. Also, please skim past the KJV translation count, because that's can also be suspect, and get down to where it has the Brown Driver Briggs and the Jesenius. Those are in BLB because they are the big classic,
yep.
Ancient, as in 1800s ancient books. But BDB is great because it's going to give you the Assyrian, the Arabic, the Phoenician,
yep.
the Nabataean, the Ethiopic, etc. And all of that is so important, the Syriac, etc. Jesenius is going to very often give you the German, which isn't very helpful, but it also is pretty good at giving you more images than maybe the BDB does.
Yeah, so... like was mentioned before, great resource to kind of get into all of those things is going to be Blue Letter Bible,
yep.
Which is an online resource. It's free.
Yep. The only thing, it is still organized by Strong's. And so you just got to click the back and forth arrows. So again, I was talking about the word pakad, and that's H6485. And so what you want to do is keep scrolling to 86 and 87 and 88 to see all the ways that it continues to show up, right? And the last question is, I have had a number of people send me videos. I can relate, John, of people interpreting the names of the line of Adam. In their interpretation, they state the names express a sentence that tells of Jesus's coming. Have you heard of this? I have not heard of this thing specifically. It's totally possible to pull all sorts of things out of all sorts of passages of scripture, right? And kind of the question is how close-handed... which you allude to not being something that you want to do, but are we going to be about the theories and the cool connections we come out with? How much are we going to use them as the answer, right? If somebody tries to talk about Adam's genealogy, is it going to be the first thing we launch like a trebuchet at others, right? Are we going to be like, actually, that was about the coming of Jesus? How functional is it is another question that I like to bring hermeneutically to any interpretation. Does this cool fact, does this chiasm, does this possibility of a Jesus illusion, with an A, not with an I, does it serve God's people in a particular capacity? Or does it remain in the category of cool fact, bro, right? So the fact that we're sending multiple videos, sometimes you want to share something that you find cool, right? There's nothing particularly wrong with that. But are we insecure about Jesus being God? Are we insecure about, like, the Old Testament is only valid if, like, everything is about Jesus and everything points to Jesus and every story is secretly about Jesus? Just, again, critical thinking, critical questions. Where does that desire come from? Where does that urge to make everything about Jesus as one member of the Trinity come from, right? So that's kind of the posture that I approach those things with. If we're just celebrating a cool potential thing in the text, that's awesome. If we're using it to be like, see, I told you everything's about Jesus. Like, okay, why is that? You know, do we not feel like Tanakh has rich wisdom, an important theology about God without us finding some like mystical connection to the coming of Jesus, right? Can it be what it is on its own and have us be excited about it without that? We love our Jesus illusions over here too. You know, yeah. We pop those in all the time. So it's not that we're against doing that. Just worth taking some reflection to think about why it is that we get so excited about those.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that, especially in interpretation, you can go all over the place,
right?
To make things, you know, it's difficult to be objective and start out without any biases,
right? No,
and
impossible.
Go through a list like that. I think that. With that, right, we've got some great genealogies in Matthew that are doing that, and the Gospels. I think 3 of the 4 Gospels have the genealogies that try and, not try, do bring a line to Jesus, and some of them are doing that from Adam. So we do have examples of that in New Testament, right, in the Gospel writings of people doing that for a specific reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I recall when we did the genealogy of Adam in Genesis, you had some cool stuff that you were doing.
It wasn't
necessarily that particular thing. But yeah, there's a wealth of stuff, a wealth of different angles and ways you turn the gem and see different rainbows pop out of it.
Yeah.
Right? And we don't want to trample on any of those things.
And I like, as far as personal, like hermeneutic, I like starting with hermeneutic. Hermeneutics, I like starting with, you know, Tanakh and bringing that forward rather than trying to bring everything back.
Right, to Jesus all the time. Jesus. Because when Jesus talks, he's quoting Tanakh all the time, right? So.
Right, we get in a circular feedback loop.
Right.
But, you know, it doesn't mean it's not worthwhile to look for those things.
Totally. Let people be excited about the stuff they're excited about in general, while still retaining critical thinking about why we might be really excited about some things. Okay, Ali asks a question about Hebrews 11. One of their pastors taught on Hebrews 11 with a focus on verses 8 through 12, talking about the faith of Abraham and Sarah. Those verses felt a little off to me, says Ali, especially after coming back again and again to the Hagar story as I've been listening to your podcast. Neither Sarah nor Abraham really walked by faith, in quotes, with regards to the promise of their descendants. Instead, they took things into their own hands and oppressed Hagar to get what they want. So for lack of better phrasing, my question is, what's the deal? Surely the writer of Hebrews knew the Hagar story and was familiar with its echoes later in Torah, so knew it was a big big deal. So why does this part of Abraham and Sarah's story get held up as a model of faith in that passage? Great question, Allie. I love putting the spotlight on Hagar, as you did further in other parts of that email. I think your points are super valid. Yeah. Sarah and Abraham's faith certainly has its twists and turns. I think there's two ways to approach this question. One is by doing a good exegesis of what the author of Hebrews is doing in the Hall of Faith passage. Because there are other kind of sketchy members in that lineup, right? There's Lot is called a righteous man.
Right.
Boy, oh boy, I would not. Well, maybe that's in Peter, actually. I think it is Peter who calls Lot a righteous man. So that would not be one of the first adjectives that comes to mind when I think about Lot. And so there's work to be done there about saying, what is she, bum, 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 trying to accomplish through that list? What is she putting together by lining up all those people, right? Is it something a little bit more at an angle, right? Tell it slant. There's that poem that we often use about parables. That's an Emily Dickinson poem, Tell the Truth But Tell It Slant. Is she telling something slant there in that particular list of lineup that's supposed to make you say, wait a second, what about Hagar? The other way that I might come at that question is to say, what does it mean to walk by faith, right? I totally agree with you that Sarah and Abraham frequently took things into their own hands, and sometimes that included oppressing Hagar, right? There's no arguing with the fact that sending her out into the desert was not like a compassionate, generous, righteous, loving thing to do.
Right.
And you could come up with all sorts of reasons why maybe it was okay and maybe there knew there was a well, blah, 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 blah. But still it uses the word oppress. Right. I think we translated it, drove Hagar harshly into the ground with hard labor is what Sarah did. That's not the
same thing that we get later with Egypt and the Israelites.
Right. Yeah. So we don't want to do apologetics to try to make every protagonist of scripture incredible and flawless, right? I think that is the opposite of the point of those stories. And so instead, we'd say, what does it mean to walk by faith? I think what Sarah and Abraham do consistently from Genesis 12 to when they're in Egypt to in this story with Hagar is they do take things into their own hands. Is there a tension between having the chutzpah to take things into your own hands? Is that somehow on the other side of faith? Or could you use that as a faith expression, right?
Right.
I think sometimes in the American church, when we say like, you gotta have faith, that means like sit on your hands and wait and just know that God's gonna turn up for you and things will work out. But there is a way to cast each of those stories, even when they make mistakes, even when those mistakes are so severe that in George and I's interpretation, it earns 400 years of slavery in order to make sure they don't do that again. Is faith, is the act of trust something that urges us to take the reins of what God is doing and to try to participate, right? Abraham, by faith, took off from Ur of the Chaldim, right? To this land that he's never seen before. Sarah, by faith, believed that they were going to have a great nation, right? She just didn't believe that she was going to be part of that promise, which is partially Abraham's fault, right? For not looping her in and allowing that to happen, right? But yet they were still trying to make that promise happen. She wasn't just like, well, YOLO, I'm going to enjoy all this riches that we've got from Egypt, right? And just chill and not worry about it. She was still trying to make the promise happen. So is there something of faith and faithfulness and trust in that, even with all the mistakes made along the way? I would hazard yes. And perhaps, though I don't have Hebrews 11 in front of me right now, that's the encouraging thing about that passage, that these people, with their chutzpah, with their dress, with their faithfulness, with their belief, set off to try to partner with God, even though they were full of mistakes, right. Even though the mistakes they made were not small, right? David was a murderer, for instance, right? And therefore, it's that cloud of witnesses that surrounds us that's comforting.
Right.
And rather than like, I don't want to be surrounded by a bunch of spiritual ancestors who are totally perfect and never made any mistakes and are now glaring at me. Right. That would be not comforting or not enlivening. That would just be scary.
Yeah.
So,
and I think we see that shown in the episode we just had with Exodus 35, right? God's not seeking those individuals who are perfect and the most skillful.
Right.
He wants those who are generous of heart.
Right. Wise of heart, willingly generous.
Yeah.
Who want to show up.
They're seeking experiential knowledge of God, mm-hmm. right? They're seeking all of these things. They're pursuing relationship, right? And
yep.
So walking in faith does not mean, like you said, walking perfectly,
right?
But rather the willingness to walk,
to say,
despite all of these things,
my earring might be small, but you can have it.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for your question, Allie.
All right. That brings us to Beverly, who asks about specifically our background as it pertains to faith and education and life.
I mean, I'm presuming specifically talking about education. I could be wrong. That would be a very, very long episode for like, well, here is the life story, Beverly.
Everything.
Thank you for asking.
In the 1700s.
Yeah, my ancestors came on a boat. Oh, that's true. But it was the 1600s. For background, I appreciate the chance to review for people who don't remember or who are not familiar. So, educational background. Most recently, I got my master's degree from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where I lived for a number of years in order to receive my degree, which was called a Master of Arts in the Bible and its ancient Near Eastern context. So, I did a little bit of a Hermione move where I took a whole bunch of Jewish studies classes. I took all of the archaeology classes that were offered in English. I nearly actually had enough credits to add another degree, but I didn't want to do all of the language requirements to do that. So that's what I did for quite a few years. So a lot of the things that I'm saying are brought from that context, a academic research university, which does a lot of things in both the Jewish studies and archaeology and biblical studies. That's my most recent background.
Yeah.
Before that, we worked in the church ever since we graduated. Before that, we were in undergrad and BAMA students when Marty was teaching on campus from the BAMA podcast. And before that, I had a very, very, very rigorous Reformed theology background that I grew up in. Lots of Puritans, lots and lots of note taking. And class on apologetics and church history and all of the things.
Yeah.
So that's the generalized background. I hope that answers your question. Feel free to send another email if you meant a different kind of background. How did we meet? That would be a fun addendum for some other time. Okay, Kevin asks, should we, being he and his family, attend a church knowing that the main preacher has stated that the Old Testament is not for us. Us is capitalized. Same preacher has stated that they are a New Testament church. We have learned that you cannot understand the New Testament if you do not know the Hebrew text. Well, Kevin, that is a very, very complex question with myriad of factors that George nor I are equipped to answer for you. Because there are many, many, many reasons to stay at a church, and there might be many, many reasons to leave a church, right? it is possible to attend a church that has different beliefs than you on things that are not central to your faith, right? So that's where you start to get into trouble, right? If you were to attend a church that was like, well, the teachings of Jesus, I mean, they're more like guidelines anyway, then, you know, if that's a central part of your faith, then that should be something to think about. But there's lots of questions, right? How does your spouse feel? How do your children feel?
Are there other churches in the area that you could go to?
Right. Yeah. Are the other preachers, other than this particular person, have a different perspective? What potentially are the, what was the intention behind them saying that, right? Because certainly taken at face value, the Old Testament is not for us, is a challenging thesis, at least for me to defend. However, what people can mean by that is like the Mosaic covenant is not for us, right? So like Levitical law is not for us. You can definitely make that argument. We are, according to Paul, right, brought into the covenant of Abraham, not necessarily as Gentiles, the covenant of Moses.
Right.
You can say, you know, there's a lot of ways that you can turn that just a little bit. Perhaps they meant, right, like the curses that are put out in the Old Testament are not for us because according to some theology, Jesus canceled those curses when he became a curse for us. Galatians, right? So there's a lot of nuance there, even if the statement as a whole has a lot of spikes and red flags on it, at least for me. But saying we're a New Testament church can mean like we have as our primary way of walking the path, the teachings of Jesus. I would agree with that statement for my household, that the teachings of Jesus are the lens through which we think about how we live our life, right?
Yep.
You can say we're a New Testament church because we believe that the curses have been broken, generational curses have been broken, right? Referencing things from that are close to the heart of some denominations and not for others. Sometimes that's what people mean when they say that. If they mean every book of the Hebrew Bible is garbage and should never be studied or read, and anyone who tries to bring it up is old-fashioned and, you know, just needs to get on Christ and Christ alone is the only thing we should ever think about, then certainly, you're going to have some problems because, as you said, understanding the teachings of Jesus without knowing the Hebrew Bible is an incredibly challenging task and can lead you to many misunderstandings, some of which are benign and some of which aren't benign, right? So I do not want to answer that question about whether you should attend or not. Because there's so many factors. I don't know how much privilege and how much platform you have, right, to make a difference or not. Maybe you have none. Maybe you have more than you think. Maybe you have a lot. And so you never know how introducing different ideas might be something you're able to do or might not. But different things to navigate there. I would say that unless a church is abusive, unless it is opening doorways to spiritual trauma and is actively hurting people in the community, and if that is the case, run away. However, right, the way that we assess a teacher being a false teacher or not is by their fruit, right? So if the fruit of a place is still good, but their atonement theory annoys you or something else about their systematic theology feels wrong, I personally would suggest staying. And I know that doesn't work for everyone. And I know that there's a million different factors, but, and if there's a really great church in your area that you want to, hop over to and give your tithes to, then awesome. You know, there's other ways to practice dissent other than just leaving wholesale. Right. Maybe think about those, pray about those, talk with other people in your community about those, talk with people who know your situation, talk with your spouse, all of the above.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. Yeah, so sounds like a very challenging position, Kevin. Prayers to you in navigating that. Let's go to Linda, who asks, I would love to put my name on the list of purchasers purchasers for both your upcoming Hebrew translation of Scripture and the Book of Belonging, which we talked about a little bit earlier. She references an article in Christianity Today about the Kickstarter campaign, and Linda mentions that she wasn't able to figure out how to support the book. So can you tell us a little bit about what is going on there, along with the Hebrew translation, just an update?
Yep, absolutely. I love this question, Linda. Thank you. So you are right. The Kickstarter has ended, and that's because it's coming out so soon, which is so exciting. So if you Google pre-order Book of Belonging, the first link that pops up is The Book of Belonging by Marika Clark, and the website is Penguin Random House. And if you click on that, it has this button that says pre-order from, and then gives you 8 options to choose where you would like to pre-order from. So you are able to do that. Very exciting. Mine does not have a pre-order yet, again, because of what you alluded to, struggling with my concussion. I do have a Shabbat. What's that called? It's not called a Shabbat.
Sabbatical.
I do have a sabbatical coming up in my church year, as is our pattern. And so I'm looking forward to knocking that out at that time, along with other writing retreat opportunities. So thanks for waiting for it. I know it's taking so much longer than anyone would like. My publisher would like. I would like. All the wonderful listeners out there who want a physical copy, I totally get it. Apologies. But I will let y'all know when it is available for pre-order.
Yeah.
Tobias has 2 questions out of Exodus. In the episode 34A, we talk about stone quarrying. If you recall, Moshe has to go and quarry a new stone for the tablets of the law. And he says, Tobias says, this makes me think of Yosef, father of Jesus. Could it be a remez? I totally love that.
I think it's great, especially with how he's portrayed, which is just a very minor figure, truly, in the New Testament.
Sure.
Right? Very little details. And one of the details we are given is that he is some sort of craftsman.
Right. Yeah. And the evidence from Beit Lechem is that that specifically would be stone quarrying. So you're right on the money, Tobias. I love that, because Jesus, of course, is our second tabernacle, our place of the indwelling of God, as we see in the opening chapter of John, the gospel. We see that again too with the giving of the law when Jesus goes up the mountain, right? And God has all these things that mirror the giving of the law,
right,
with Jesus. And so who is the one who quarried the stone so that that could happen? Yosef trusting in this dream from an angel, right? So the stone quarrier, that's hard to say. Tobias's second question points out from Exodus 9 that the hand and spirit of Adonai are linguistically feminine. That is true. Ruach of God is feminine. It is one of my pet peeves, talking about things that annoy you, when people refer to the Holy Spirit as a him. It's either a she or a they, depending on if you're following the Greek or the Hebrew. So stop it, everyone. The hand and spirit of God are linguistically feminine. What about the voice of God? Great question. I believe
in Mulan.
I believe that the word for voice, and I just double checked that to make sure I was not making things up, is masculine. The first time we see it is the voice of God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, right, in Genesis 3. Which to me, that lines up, because the word of God is Jesus. Jesus is masculine, right? So voice, word, Jesus, all masculine.
Okay,
that makes
yeah.
sense to me. But yes, the hand of God, all hands actually are feminine, and all spirits, including the one of God, is also feminine. So we've got duality within the character of God. Tobias, thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, thanks, Tobias, for such a great question. Our next Listener question comes from Ryan, who asks about Exodus chapter 34. And he's going to quote this verse here. Neither will any find your land pleasing when you go up to be seen before the face of Yahweh three moments in the year. And he was asking translationally, if that's a word, about the correlation between the 10 words and the preceding commands that the Lord gives. And he's Ryan is working through the Hebrew here, and trying to work his way through to see how you come up with your translation. So he provided a summary of verse 23 here, showing some Hebrew English translation, and asked specifically about the appearing three times in the year and how that fits within the structure of the sentence.
Great Hebrew question, Ryan. Love to get in the weeds sometimes. So you're right, they're not in the 10 words there, but there's more to that verse than just those 10 words. The whole thing is longer than those 10 words. And so what you might be experiencing is a syntax issue, or maybe you just missed that line. But he has this line, I'm reading from my interlinear since you copy-pasted your interlinear. It says, for I will cast out the nations before you and enlarge their borders. And then there's this line, that's the one of my translation that you quoted about no one will find it pleasing. This interlinear goes, and neither will any man covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God three times in the year. So it's just not in your screenshot. It comes right before your screenshot. It should say, specifically, lo yachmod ish et aretzecha. Something like that is what it should say. So hope that helps. Scroll up a little. It should be there. Finally, Mary asking, hope this finds you well. I was wondering if this translation is in print anywhere. No, it is not. Hopefully it will be in the future. Thank you again for everyone's interest and perseverance and hope that I will be able to get that knocked out of the park so everyone can have it in their homes. Thank you so much for wanting that. Okay, that's what we have for this time. Thank you to everyone who sent in such thoughtful and kind questions. So much encouragement that we didn't read out loud here, but you guys buoy our spirits to keep doing this work. We're so thankful that God chooses to use the stuff that we do in a helpful way to people. So thank you for reminding us that that's the case. And that's not just us talking at each other across... right now, it's our son's bedroom. So we appreciate that.
Yep. All right. This has been the Text and Us podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. And we hope that you will join us again when we return to the text in the book of Exodus.